Today on Against the Grain, in the aftermath of the shutdown of far-right celebrity Milo Yiannopoulos at UC Berkeley, there's been much debate amongst progressives and leftists about the use of militant tactics against the right. Some of the questions debated are whether such tactics bring down repression on the most vulnerable, and whether free speech is sacrosanct, even for fascists. I'll be joined by undocumented UC Berkeley student Juan Prieto to talk about why he supported the shutdown. And a longtime anti-fascist organizer will join me to discuss the history of the group Anti-Racist Action. He'll make the case for mass militant action against the right. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Last February, three people were stabbed protesting a Ku Klux Klan rally in Anaheim, California, while in July, seven people in Sacramento were stabbed opposing a white supremacist group. Last month, an anti-fascist was shot in the stomach by a supporter of the far-right propagandist Milo Yiannopoulos. Yet militant tactics against the far right have proved quite controversial amongst progressives, especially following the shutdown of Yiannopoulos' event at UC Berkeley. Later in the program, I'll be joined by one of the founders of the youth-based militant direct action movement Anti-Racist Action. But first, I'm joined by Juan Prieto. He's an undocumented student at UC Berkeley and has spoken out in defense of those who used militant action to shut down Milo Yiannopoulos' event on the campus on February 1st. Juan, why did you think Yiannopoulos should have been prevented from speaking? What was at stake?
Yeah, I think on January 31st, Breitbart, which is Milo's main news outlet, which was, you know, controlled by Steve Bannon, and maybe I think created by Steve Bannon, they released an article stating that they would be launching a campaign. Well, Milo and the Horowitz Freedom Center, I believe.
Right, we're gonna David Horowitz.
Right. We're going to be launching a campaign against undocumented students in sanctuary campuses. The article specifically said that they would target administrators, including Janet Napolitano and Nicholas Dirks. It is known that Horowitz had helped Milo before in other of his speeches, and they've posted signs of students to demonize them and make them the target of the campus right. And so it became very clear to us that if they were going to come after undocumented students, it wasn't just going to be targeting the administration, but perhaps also some of us who are most outspoken. And then this was made clear to us, and it seemed the administration also knew. There was an email correspondence between Berkeley administration and Berkeley College Republican, which was released in the Berkeley side, which clearly made it seem that not only did the university know that they were going to launch a campaign against sanctuary campuses, but they also were concerned that they would out and target undocumented students. And so even though the university was very aware of this, it wasn't enough for them to stop it. And so I feel like any, you know, this event needed to be stopped by any means necessary, because not only would he have outed, would he have possibly outed undocumented students and launched a campaign against us, but his following is known to be some of the worst of the right. So, you have white supremacists, neo-Nazis, and alternative right fascists, or fascies as they call themselves, who would have been given a platform to organize and then have targets on our campus. The Berkeley College Republicans have been seen hanging out with People from Identity Europa, which is a Bay Area white supremacist organization. And so for us, the safety of our own community was at stake.
There's been a lot of controversy and debate that has followed the shutting down that took place February 1st, and a lot of national reporting about it. And it has been a sort of polarizing issue amongst progressives, with some people coming out in support and a lot of people condemning it. One of the things that has been brought up in the critiques of what happened that night is that you had mass number of people who were there as demonstrators, and then a smaller group of people, some of whom were dressed in black, who used militant tactics to pull barricades down, did some smashing of windows of the student center where the event was. And in the ways that this has often been depicted, it's been mass crowds versus this group, that this group came in and did something which was not supported by the larger group. What did you see?
Yeah, I think everyone who was present wanted that event to be stopped. That was made very clear that people, even if their intent was to protest peacefully, what they wanted was that event to be stopped. There had been efforts weeks prior to the Milo appearance to stop that event, and a lot of the people who had been attempting to stop it were present at that protest. And
you mean who used other channels that were not militant to try and stop
right.
it?
Right. They had used, you know, meeting with Dirks, letting him know the dangers of having someone
this
like Milo
Stat,
Chancellor Dirks, right. And then there were, you know, there were op-eds written. There were donors calling to make sure that, you know, or to attempt to stop him from coming onto our campus. And so there were all these peaceful tactics being used to try to stop him. Unfortunately, a peaceful protest and a dance, which was also planned, was not going to stop Milo. The university had made it clear that no peaceful efforts was going to actually stop them from allowing him to speak. And for allowing his white supremacists to organize on our campus. So when the Antifa, which is the anti-fascist organization or group of anti-fascists from different organizations, came together took part of the protest, to them it became very clear that the only way they were going to cancel that event was to shatter the windows. And yeah, there seems to be this divide now that, you know, that the protest, peaceful protesters and the Antifa were somehow against each other. At the moment, students were celebrating. We were celebrating that event had been canceled. A lot of what doesn't get covered in the media is the celebration that happened right after it was announced that it was canceled. And it was only canceled because broken glass and fireworks. The generator was tipped over, but if you watch, I think, BuzzFeed's video, it shows that it caught fire on its own, although the media will make it seem otherwise. They might not say that it caught fire on its own, but they'll show pictures that make it seem like it's...
One of the things that alarmed people reading about what took place that night when people shut down Milo Yiannopoulos and kept him from speaking was what was reported as the beating up of various passerbys. Those who were on the scene had a different story to tell. What did you witness and what did you understand took place? A number of these people then spoke to the television cameras and said they had been attacked by protesters.
Yeah, I'll be quite honest. I didn't join the protest until once it was canceled. A lot of undocumented students, we stayed indoors in fear that if the Milo event took place and students were outed, we would become targets of his followers. And so a lot of us didn't go out until the event was canceled. In fact, as soon as it was canceled, I was with 3 undocumented friends. We ran out. I do know people who saw a particular man who was shown with blood streaming down his face, who kept flinging himself at protesters. I have a couple of friends, some friends who don't even know each other, who said, yeah, like he kept jumping at people and flinging his arms. And as soon as he was hit, ran to all the cameras and repeated the exact same message. So,
and gave a false name to the media.
Right. I feel like there was a sensational, they wanted to sensationalize this and make it more dramatic than it actually was. And by having him with blood streaming down his face, it gave him that credibility, especially to the right wing media. And so he would just repeat the exact same message. This is Trump's America. Like, this is what happens if you try to speak at liberal university. It was just that same message he kept repeating through all the news outlets. And unfortunately, the mass media has picked it up, and they didn't pick up the fact that students' lives might have been saved that night.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and I'm speaking with Juan Prieto. He's an undocumented student at UC Berkeley. And we're discussing the events of February 1st, where students and community members shut down a talk by the far-right propagandist Milo Yiannopoulos. So one of the criticisms that has been brought up in the past against militant tactics, often called black bloc tactics, although I think that term can often be actually confusing to people because they think it's a specific group of people going around and doing something. But one of the concerns that has been brought up about people taking militant direct action involving property damage and even physical violence against the far right is that it makes an unsafe situation for other demonstrators, particularly people who are undocumented or might be vulnerable for other reasons. So then the police come down once an action is taken. Often the people who might have initiated the actions take off because they have some experience in these actions. And the vulnerable people end up getting caught up by the police. What's your response to that kind of criticism?
Yeah, well, comparing it to that night, there was no way I felt unsafe while I was with anyone that night. There was a lot of, like I said, celebration, and there was a way by which you could sort of remain safe should the police arrive. The Antifa, who were these ninjas, as Nicholas Dirks calls them, were sort of leading the marches, were clearing up the way as they move forward, were on ends of the crowds to ensure that if police should come, they're the ones who are dealing with it. There wasn't a moment that any of my friends felt like we could become easy targets for the police. But if so, I mean, I feel like this should be a criticism of the police, not necessarily the people taking these tactics to save our community. You know, if the police isn't going to protect us from people coming onto our campus and spreading hate and allowing hatred to organize itself, but the community's rising up, then the police needs to step aside because, you know, we need to protect our community by any means.
So clearly you're taking a big risk in speaking out as an undocumented person. And I wanted to know what you think undocumented people and their allies can do in the age of Trump to try to stop deportations. Last Wednesday, people in Phoenix, Arizona, physically blocked the vehicles of ICE, that is the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, from deporting Guadalupe Garcia de Reyes. She was, however, deported the following morning. One of the first people to be deported under Trump. Do you think that direct action and militant direct action is warranted to protect the undocumented?
Yeah, I think direct action is the only way we're going to be able to stop deportations at the moment. It's being made very clear that sort of whatever safety nets we might have had under previous administrations are suddenly not there. Even though Obama did deport 3 million people, it seems like now it's sort of like that machine that Obama created, the gears are spinning quick. And so there's a lot of anxiety in the undocumented community as it pertains to what our rights are going to be, what our rights as organizers are going to be, but also just what our rights as people walking around sidewalks are going to be. So it's being made clear that if direct actions are not being taken to protect deportations, then people are just passively allowing them to happen. It's going to take shutting down streets where a deportation bus might be going through, or it might even require us to shut down deportation facilities or detention centers. I think we need to focus on that as well. There are people now trying to figure out what goes on inside of them, and it seems like it's one of the most inhumane places to be in at the moment. And so we need to take direct action and be bold. And, you know, I'm speaking to allies up in the state capitol as well. There needs to be a backbone. People need to rise up to the occasion. This presidency is not normal. This presidency is going down on our communities very quickly. And if we don't rise up against it and take direct action, a lot of us might not be here by the end of the next 4 years. So, yeah, I think for undocumented folks, it is a matter of waiting to see what's going on. It seems like some of the executive orders are attempting to criminalize anything we do. And so there was an anxiety that was spreading across organizers about, whether those of us who had been previously arrested taking direct action were at risk of deportation because we had dealings with the police. I've talked to some lawyers, and they've told me that that doesn't seem to be the case, especially if the charges were dismissed or if there were no charges pressed to begin with, that you should be fine if that's the case. But who's to say moving forward that these charges don't become more crucial in deciding whether or not a person should be deported? And so that's when we're going to need our allies and accomplices to rise with us, to shut down buses, get arrested for us while we attempt to figure out a way to survive in this political climate.
I've been speaking with undocumented student Juan Prieto. He's a student at UC Berkeley, and he was there on February 1st when students and community members shut down an event on campus by Milo Yiannopoulos, the far-right propagandist. Juan, thank you so much for coming in.
No, thank you for having me.
We'll take a music break and be back with a longtime anti-fascist organizer who is one of the co-founders of Anti-Racist Action. You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Today we're talking about the use of militant tactics against the far right. And I'm joined now by an anti-fascist organizer who prefers just to be identified by his first name. Kieran was one of the founders of Anti-Racist Action, a youth-based direct action movement which organized against Nazi skinheads, the Ku Klux Klan, and the white power music scene from the 1980s to the 2000s. He's now chief steward in a local union of telecom workers and is a member of the Industrial Workers of the World's General Defense Committee, which has taken on anti-fascist work in a number of cities. In late January, a member of the General Defense Committee of the IWW was shot at a Milo Yiannopoulos event in Seattle. Kieran, many liberals and leftists believe that the right of free speech is paramount. As you know, protesters using militant tactics shut down a Milo Yiannopoulos event at UC Berkeley 2 weeks ago, which is the home of the free speech movement. Why don't you think that the right of free speech should be extended to fascists and the far right?
There's a couple points to this. I think there's both a question of strategy and tactics. I think, but all of this is with the understanding that what we're opposing is not the free speech of fascists or the speech of the fascists. What we're doing is opposing the organizing of the fascists. So, for instance, in my workplace, you know, I work with workers with a whole range of opinions on all different kinds of questions. And occasionally, you're going to run into people who are influenced by far-right politics. In those circumstances, it doesn't make sense for me to, you know, start a fight, a physical fight with a coworker, since that they raise some perspective that comes from that background. But that's totally different than a situation where you have an organization or a personality who's using the framework of a public speech or an event, a forum, in order to advance political goals. And so the way we look at it is the way we would look at any kind of organizing done by that group with those aims. In the case at UC Berkeley, this alt-right celebrity and provocateur, Milo Yiannopoulos, who very clearly is trying to advance a certain kind of politics and more is trying to shape it into a movement. Our understanding is that he was planning to out undocumented students at Berkeley, you know, for the sole purpose of putting them under attack by Trump's immigration forces. And so in that circumstance, you know, we can't let that attack go unchallenged. And I think that when you look at it from that perspective, it makes sense to try and oppose it. You know, if we just wait until they've created the groundswell or created the base of support for these aggressive actions to take place, it can be too late. And so the way we approach the fascist organizing or right-wing organizing is not really focused on the question of free speech, but is focused on whether or not we're going to let them organize to implement their program. And our perspective is that we're not. We're going to challenge it. We're going to try and stop it. We're going to try and stop them.
Well, let's talk about the stakes, in fact. On, I think it was on the night of Inauguration Day, a fellow member of the Industrial Workers of the World, and you are a member of that, was shot in the stomach by a Milo Yiannopoulos supporter in Seattle. What do we know about what happened there and the condition of the man who was shot?
Yeah, that's correct. On the night of the inauguration, Yiannopoulos was speaking at the University of Washington in Seattle, and there was a mass demonstration against him that included a range of political forces. And there was also a number of supporters of Trump and Yiannopoulos who were there as well. And so there was a fairly confrontational scene happening outside of Yiannopoulos' talk. And in that situation, my understanding is that one of the right-wingers started to spray mace or another chemical at the anti-Trump, anti-Yiannopoulos forces, and that a member of the IWW and the General Defense Committee tried to intervene to stop that person from doing that and was shot in the stomach, as you said. It was a life-threatening injury. He was in the ICU for many days. He's incurred at least two surgeries and is not out of the hospital yet. So it was a deadly attack. And as of now, there have been no charges brought against the person who did it. Again, our understanding from media reports is that the person that shot him went to the police and gave a statement and was released without any charges. And so, of course, this is sort of a bad sign for where things are at right now, and something that we take very seriously. Because as it stands, you know, what it appears is that some people are going to walk away with this, with the idea that anti-fascists can be shot without consequences. And that's very dangerous.
And in fact, that's been the case. This past summer, there was a confrontation between white supremacists and radicals in Sacramento, California, where a number of people got stabbed and there was no consequence for the fascists who did it.
Right. Yeah, and I think that just points to, a broader point, which is that we can't rely on law enforcement, on the state, to either defend our communities or defend anti-fascists. And so some anti-racists have a perspective of wanting to try and, you know, call on the state to carry out justice. And our approach is a little different. You know, we come from it with an understanding that the state is not neutral, that the state is built on a foundation of history of exploitation and oppression, and represents the folks who are at the top of that system and defends their interests. And so when we're organizing, we don't do so from the point of view of trying to get the state or the police to protect us or to find justice for us, but instead we try and build movements that are self-reliant and are based on community self-defense, on popular self-defense.
I'm going to ask you later in the program more about the state, but just staying for a moment more with the kind of debate that sprung up after the shutting down of the Milo Yiannopoulos event. There's been a lot of debate amongst progressives and leftists about the use of militant tactics. Some of this is a continuation of debates that came out of Occupy. Some of this goes even further back. But a lot of conflicting opinions, no unity whatsoever amongst the left about the use of militant tactics, whether property damage or the shutting down of an event or something like that. So what I wanted to ask you is, are there times when militant tactics aren't called for? Do they need to be considered strategically among other possible tactics?
Yeah, I mean, I think all of this is, you know, questions of tactics. So that being said, I think we have some underlying principles as well, and that those inform the tactics that, that we would draw from in order to organize effectively. And you can imagine lots of different situations where you're encountering the right or the fascist, where either you don't have the means to effectively disrupt their activity and their organizing, or you want to sort of put a larger emphasis on trying to undermine their ability to develop their base. And so there's a few things, and it's never been just a question of militant tactics. Militant tactics is a part of our strategy, but it's not the only part. A big part of it is sort of a battle for the hearts and minds of the people that the fascists are trying to recruit for their base. And so we've always, along with militant tactics against their organizing, have also tried to engage with the communities that the fascists are targeting. And that can be from, you know, interviews like this or leafleting to building cultural events like shows with bands, to trying to connect with the people in those communities that already have an anti-fascist impulse, you know, possibly because of, you know, their identity or how they see the world. But we try and bring a message that this program that the right wing and the fascists are selling is, you know, not in our interests as working class people, and that you know, that it's a dangerous and divisive one, and that it's going to, you know, lead to a common catastrophe if enacted. And in fact, many of the concerns people have would be better served by organizing a united, multiracial, multicultural anti-fascist movement that challenges the system.
Well, one of the things that comes up in these debates came up after the in the debate that has taken place over the last couple of weeks is an argument, not just from liberals, but also by some people on the left, that militant action can actually be alienating for those who would like to build larger grassroots opposition to the right. How would you respond to that?
I've heard those arguments a lot. And I think, you know, it's true that sometimes there's poorly organized or militancy that's not well thought out. But I hear that argument oftentimes from people who are really obsessed with how the mainstream media covers us, or how the more moderate tendencies within the social movements react to it. And I think instead, while those things are important to be mindful of, I think that there's also a question of people beyond the current left, people in working class communities, people who already are suspicious of what the mainstream media tells us. And I just think it's a fact that most working class people respect folks that stand up and that are willing to defend themselves and that are willing to take risks. And so you can watch a news report in which anti-fascists or anarchists or radicals are being condemned. But people receive that information in all different kinds of ways. People that are already suspicious of the way the mainstream media talks about anything are likely to have a more positive response seeing a group of people standing up and fighting back. And so I think that that we have to be really careful about arguments like that, because I think it tends to try and reduce all of our tactics to whatever the most moderate elements within the movement are willing to support. And that's just, you know, not a recipe for building the kind of movement we need. And it's not a recipe for bringing in the most marginalized people the people that are feeling sort of the knife's edge of the system the most, because those folks already have an antagonistic attitude towards the system and towards these racists. And so if we're serious about including those folks in our movements, then we can't, you know, take a sort of moderate attitude towards them. When the racists and fascists are organizing, we have to be ready to stand up and fight.
That is the voice of anti-fascist organizer Kieran. He is joining me from Minneapolis. My name is Sasha Lilly. You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Kieran is a member of the General Defense Committee, the defensive arm of the Radical Union, the Industrial Workers of the World, and he was a founding member of Anti-Racist Action, a youth-based militant direct action movement which organized against Nazi skinheads in the white power music scene. He was one of the founders, and that movement started in the 1980s and lasted through the 2000s. And Kieran, I'd like to ask you about Anti-Racist Action. How broad was it, and what sort of work did it do? There's a kind of renewed interest in it now.
It started out sort of spontaneously in this sense. In the mid to late 80s, there was largely in the punk scene in the U.S. and Canada, there was a sort of polarization politically that happened. And so around the same time in many cities, there were white supremacists and Nazi gangs formed that were influenced by Screwdriver and the Politics, which was a Nazi skinhead band, I should say, Screwdriver, and the fascist politics of the National Front in Britain. And in response to that, or sometimes ahead of that, there were groups that considered themselves militantly anti-racist and anti-fascist. And these two sets of groups could not coexist for long within the alternative scenes, within the punk scenes. And so there was a struggle that went on simultaneously in a number of cities. And the anti-racists, who often started off as anti-racist skinheads and some punks and some anarchist activists, found each other after a while, either through touring with bands or through the letters column in Maximum Rock and Roll, or by corresponding with each other, and started to network and started to build. And so Anti-Racist Action was sort of the organized expression of that spontaneous organizing that happened in the youth subculture scenes in North America. And then over the years, it did broaden out. It started to include people that didn't come from those scenes, that came from other subcultural scenes like graffiti or young feminists and hip-hop, and started to take on a number of other issues, too, related to racism and white supremacy, so that you had anti-racist action chapters that organized cop watch patrols against police brutality, participated in protests against police violence, helped defend abortion clinics from the far-right Christian right, and a number of other fronts that anti-racist action was active. And so at its peak, it included, you know, several thousand mainly young people in North America who were, you know, self-organizing in their cities and in their scenes and putting out zines and holding benefit concerts. And really, any time the fascists tried to make a move, resisting them. So at one point in the 90s, one of the major Ku Klux Klan groups tried to organize a series of rallies across the Midwest. And they did this over the course of a couple years, in little towns and big towns in Ohio and Indiana, Wisconsin, Michigan. And anti-racist action was key to organizing resistance in all of those places. And that meant also being in those small towns and talking to people, mainly young people in those towns, and trying to connect with them. And that was successful. There were a number of ARA chapters in small towns as well as the big cities where the left is stronger. And I think anti-racist action, which had plenty of problems, as all movements do, can really say that it helped restrain and deliver some defeats to fascist organizing in the U.S.
Well, yes, on that then, how seriously did the far right take the work of anti-racist action? Did they see it as a genuine threat to their organizing? Were there consequences for the members of anti-racist action of the stand that they took?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we were the major force that they had to deal with in terms of opposition on the streets. So they were very conscious of anti-racist action. You know, there were all in every locality there would be conflicts, and there were many people who were harassed or intimidated, who you know might have gotten their homes graffitied or phone calls to their parents with threats from the fascists. They definitely saw us as an obstacle to their ability, especially their ability to organize openly and in the public and in contested public space. And I suppose the peak of this was in Las Vegas in 1998, I believe, on the 4th of July weekend. A couple of anti-racist skinheads, one who was African-American and one who was white, both of whom were well-known in the scene and active in anti-racist action, were kidnapped by a gang of white supremacists and tortured and killed and left in the desert. And so, you know, there were people that died fighting, being a part of this movement. And, I mean, that really hangs heavy for me and the other people that have been part of this, as does the shooting in Seattle, when you hear people complaining about, you know, the possible violation of Milo Yiannopoulos' rights.
Let me just ask you a question of clarification. You've mentioned several times anti-racist or anti-fascist skinheads. I think for a lot of people in America, when they hear the term skinhead, they assume that's synonymous with fascist and racist, not anti-fascist or anti-racist. Can you just quickly explain that?
Yeah, sure. So skinhead culture came to the U.S. mainly from the influence of British music bands. And the initial skinhead cultural scene from England and the bands that were the most popular within it was a multiracial scene heavily influenced by Jamaican immigrants to England. And so the skinhead identity has always been contested, and anti-racist skinheads make a strong claim that, in fact, the original skinhead identity was not a racist one and was a multiracial one. And in the U.S., among the original chapters of anti-racist action and the original fighters against white supremacist skinheads were a number of youth of color. So there were African-American skinheads in Chicago, there were Puerto Rican skinheads in Milwaukee, there was Native American skinheads in Minneapolis, and they were a big and important part of the struggle that happened against the racists.
The program is Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly, and today we're talking about the history of anti-racist and anti-fascist militant action. I'm joined by longtime anti-fascist organizer, prefers to be just known by his first name, Kieran. He is joins me from Minneapolis, where he lives and is a chief steward in a local union. From the 80s to the early 2000s, he was involved with anti-racist action, a youth-based militant direct action movement that organized against Nazi skinheads. And today he is a member of the General Defense Committee of the Radical Union, the Industrial Workers of the World. So I wonder if we could take things up to the present in terms of thinking about what the lessons are from the decades of work of anti-racist action to the current situation where with the Trump administration in power, you have a far right that is emboldened. Part of that far right, the alt-right, a lot of it is operating less on the streets and more on the level of propaganda on the internet, but then there are certainly groups on the ground as well. Can you tell us about the General Defense Committee of the Industrial Workers of the World and your political approach to countering fascist and racist forces on the ground?
Yeah, definitely. I think you're right in describing the situation right now. You know, we've gone from a situation where we were sort of concerned about the growth of particular fascist and white supremacist organizations and their movement building, to a different situation where all of a sudden, particularly through the alt-right, there's sort of this mass propaganda and mass distribution of fascist ideas, so that it's no longer just about the growth of a neo-Nazi group in a certain town, but it's the fact that the college Republicans on your campus are peddling alt-right ideas. And so, and also that's circulating on social media and that it's become a part of the public debate in a way that the neo-Nazi groups and Ku Klux Klan groups could never quite achieve, you know, in the past couple decades. So that is a serious situation. And I think, you know, the thing that the GDC brings to this, or is trying to formulate, is connecting the concepts of community self-defense, popular self-defense, a popular anti-fascism, with the idea that we need to cultivate a working class base, that it can't just be sort of a squadron of elite anti-fascists carrying out a technical operation that's going to win this, that we need to get the masses of working class people in our millions, you know, from all different kinds of communities and identities together. And that's what it's going to take to, you know, defeat the politics that Trump is putting forward and the system that, you know, gave birth to it. So I think that while we are proud to be militant anti-fascists and we take that identity seriously and we take those tactics seriously, we don't want to marginalize ourselves. We don't want to sort of just be what Lorenzo Camboa Irvin called a sort of vanguard versus vanguard, where people just see two street gangs fighting with each other and don't really see their needs or demands met by either one of them. Instead, we want to try and organize ourselves and our coworkers and our neighbors into a popular response to the fascists, one that so that when we take action, we're not just doing it on behalf of a small cadre of people, but that it's really an expression of a community and of the working class as a whole.
Well, how do you do that in practical terms?
Well, I think in many ways it's how we talk about it. It's who we try and involve in our actions. It's the way we the way that we report about and the way that we sum up our actions, the way we decide if we're successful or not. So it's not just purely a question of are we able to disrupt their organizing on this day, but it's also a question of were we able to help develop a base within this community or within this working class that is going to be able to continually confront the fascists and make it a hard place for the fascists to organize and grow. So like some concrete examples of that might be when neo-Nazis plan to organize against an anti-racist program that was being held by a local YWCA in Minneapolis a few years ago. We took that as an attack on the community. We organized leafleting in the neighborhood. We encouraged the neighbors to come out, community to come out. We held a public meeting so that we gave a chance for people from the neighborhood and from different other organizations to sort of become part of the organizers of the counteraction. When there were some reformist leftist groups that came and really argued against any kind of militancy, you know, we argued with them in the open meetings, you know, so that there could be a sort of community judgment about which tactics were best. And then myself, you know, I coached soccer for youth soccer in the parks here in Minneapolis, and I, you know, I let other parents from the folks that I coach with let them know about this since it was in our neighborhood, and I distributed information about it at work and brought out coworkers to it. So our attitude is that we want to build, you know, a popular defense against this. The fascists are an attack not just on a small group of people, but really against huge communities and against the class as a whole. It weakens the class as a whole. So we want to have a popular response. I think many folks try and divide on both sides, people try and divide the concept of a mass response with a militant response, that it's only possible to do one or the other.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we really want to challenge that. We think that what's needed is both. And that's not easy. There's no simple formula to it. You know, we're going to need to experiment. We're going to get some things wrong. We're going to bend the stick too far one way or the other, undoubtedly. But that's our goal, is to build a mass militant movement that includes lots of people and that uses lots of tactics in order to confront this threat.
Well, you're the chief steward at a local union in Minneapolis, which represents telecom workers. What do you think labor's role should be in battling the forces of the right? Most unions, of course, are not the industrial workers of the world. They don't self-identify as radical, but the labor movement is really the only, even though the unions only represent a small portion at this point of the working class, still they are really the only membership-based organizations of the working class. So is there a role for unions, and is it realistic to expect them to be involved in such militant action against the right?
I think so. And I think if we look at where there have been sort of mass confrontations going back to the 80s and 90s, where some Klan rallies provoked big responses, where large numbers of people came out in Michigan and Ohio, in Pennsylvania, Indiana, lots of times you're going to run into union members who come out against that stuff. But we need to turn it away from just being sort of individual actions of individual union members to more of an organized expression. So I think you're right that unions are probably, along with churches and other houses of worship, are some of the few sort of mass membership organizations out in the class. We need to go to the unions, and if the union leadership wants to avoid it or doesn't take this seriously, then we need to, you know, build rank and file groups that are willing to take this seriously. My experience actually is that people in workplaces are incredibly interested in this stuff. If the Klan is coming to your town, or if there's fascist organizing in your city, more people than one might expect are interested in opposition to that. And I think we need to build on that. And I think hopefully the GDC, with its origins in the labor movement, can play a role in bringing on board some unions or groups of rank-and-file workers from the unions who can be a part of this movement.
Well, let me end by asking you perhaps the hardest question, which is, in thinking about opposing the right and the very serious threats that people are facing in the United States right now, is the greatest threat from fascist groups on the ground, or is the repression of the state a much more serious issue, as we're seeing with the deportations of the undocumented, first under Obama, of course, and now under Trump? And if that is the case, then how do we fight that militantly?
Right. No, it's a good question. You know, I think that, I don't think it's either or. I think that the state is becoming increasingly repressive, and part of what is allowing that to happen is, even though the Trump lost the popular vote and millions more people didn't vote for either of the candidates, the fact that he did have millions of voters allows him to present a mandate to carry out these actions. And a number of the, I read in a recent article about how Trump was very keen on using his Twitter to unleash action. So this wouldn't be formally state action. He's not necessarily calling the FBI to go harass one of his critics. But by using social media, he's able to sort of unleash a torrent of abuse on whoever he's decided is the enemy of the moment by his supporters. And so I think that there's two things. There's the danger of increased deportations, increased raids, attacks on the ability of women to get reproductive health care. There's attacks on so many fronts that's going to come from the state. And some of them will be backed by both parties. We have to be aware of that. So we're going to need to form resistance to that. And then at the same time, one of the big dangers is that, the forces on the ground you know, might live next to or work with are going to be organized into, you know, right-wing and fascist formations, or at least to be soft support for that taking place. So I think some of our tactics and our strategies are similar for both, though. You know, when we talk about organizing community self-defense, that's not just against the fascists or just against the state, but it's sort of, you know, against whatever attacks come, even from attacks within the community, from antisocial or sexist or racist elements within the community. So I think, like, the strategy that we've sort of set forth for the near term, which is organizing community self-defense, is the method that's needed for both.
I've been speaking with longtime anti-fascist organizer and founding member of Anti-Racist Action. He prefers to just be known as Kieran. Anti-Racist Action, founded in the 1980s, was a youth-based militant direct action movement which organized against Nazi skinheads and the white power music scene. Kieran is a member of the General Defense Committee, the defense arm of the Radical Union, the Industrial Workers of the World, which has taken on anti-fascist work in a number of cities, and you can find a link to the General Defense Committee on our website, againstthegrain.org. Kieran, thank you so much for joining me today.
I really appreciate it. Thank you.
You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.